Welcome to the Emotional Curriculum with me, Dr. Sarah Taylor-Whiteway. Belonging is becoming a popular word in relation to education. But how do schools know if they're doing it right? Today, we talk to Dr. Max Coates, visiting professor at Plymouth Marjon University. We discuss the definition of belonging, what it looks like when schools do it right, the difference between hedonistic and eudaimonic well-being, and how belonging for staff is just as important as belonging for children. Max, welcome to the Emotional Curriculum.
It's lovely to come, thank you.
So today we're going to talk about your research on belonging, but I wanted to start off by asking you, what got you interested in doing research in this area?
Well, it's been a life interest, really, sort of going back to early days working in the Royal Bethlehem Hospital, doing courses there, and that's a long time ago. And then it's sort of come back and come back. I was a secondary head, and I was constantly working mainly with youngsters who, shall we say, were at the poor end of the spectrum socioeconomically. And so I was always looking for where was the blue touch paper we could light that would get these youngsters learning, not only learning, but by that definition of learning, lever up their life opportunities. And that's been a very long journey. And then I worked for 16 years for the Institute of Education. And with Catherine Riley, we did quite a lot of research into place and belonging. But I've also written around emotional issues and how they operate.
So are there different definitions of belonging out there? And is there a clear definition of belonging?
Well, that's a fascinating one, because it's variously understood. For example, when I was a head teacher, I remember sitting one Friday afternoon with the senior secondary advisor for Sussex, West Sussex, and I got a disadvantaged school and trying to move things forward. And he suddenly turned to me and he said, well, what you need more than anything is stripy blazers. And I think surely we've come up with something a little more dramatic than this. That was his definition of belonging. And it sort of moved forward with something that was really what the writer, the American cultural writer, calls artifact. So you structure your school In many ways, the way that people have moved on with branding. So you have branding in an attempt to produce corporate identity, things like loyalty cards, all of those, you know, to give you the feeling that you're belonging. But in fact, I would argue very strongly that branding is not belonging, because, you know, you might have the decisions that you make of Waitrose, Aldi, Lidl, but that's not how children work. They come to something which they're in for a sustained period, which they feel that they're part of, and not only part of, but secure.
Okay, so it's this sense that some schools are trying to look for a brand, like you said, and that they think this is going to help people feel they belong because they're all under one image. Have you found a description of belonging that does fit with your idea of it?
Yes, the French writer Simone Weil, I think, provided one of the very best descriptions of belonging. And she said this: to be rooted is perhaps the most important and least recognized need of the human soul. Uprootedness is by far the most dangerous malady to which human societies are exposed. And I think that's a very powerful piece of writing. And it sort of captures the kind of thing that we've been looking at and talking. It's down to what is, in essence, a primal need. Now, contrary to that, was when I wrote a book. It's called It's Doing My Head In, which was about the issues around stress and surviving in leadership. I came across this, and this provides the antithesis. And this was published in The Guardian in 2017. And the Academy's advice to teachers on how to deal with pupils who feel sick. We all know children say things like that to get out of work. You never tend to be ill to get out of work because we expect you to work through it. If you feel sick, we'll give you a bucket. If you vomit, no problem. You've got your bucket, and that's probably all your body wanted, to vomit. If you're really ill, we'll make sure you get all the attention you need. Now, I'm not happy with that, personally.
Yeah, it's quite shocking.
Part of education, major part of education, is that you have a place that is safe enough to be you.
And so why do you think some schools are not creating this sense of belonging where people can be themselves and actually are going towards more uniformity, removing that sense of individual identity?
It's partially, we're celebrating, in inverted commas, 10 years of since Michael Gove was Secretary of State for Education. And the issue was it shifted to a commercial model of education, give it its proper title, neoliberalist sort of market forces. And the issue there is about, well, it's about achievement rather than attainment. So you measure achievement quite hard, and the result is your organization becomes focused on the achievement of results. And then you begin to structure the culture completely to support that intention. So that is quite an issue. And that's been also driven by things like the PISA data. So how do you measure the success of the school? That's the sort of question.
And so do you have examples of schools that are embracing the sense of belonging really well?
Yes, certainly. I've done some research recently, and I went to Fleetwood in Lancashire, which, I mean, is the epitome of a town which has become commercially bereft. Every industry it had, from the cod fishing industry to Irish ferries. And I went to the school called Flakefleet Primary School. That's quite hard to say at this time of morning. This was the school that was on Britain's Got Talent in the autumn. And the teacher, Dave McPartlin, can only be described as bonkers. And he really, really is. And I went in this school, and the place was astonishing. There was lots of work going on, but there were kids wandering around with trays of toast because they don't get fed. The parents are lying about the children's birthday to the children because they can't afford to buy birthday presents. But the school finds out about, and Dave takes the children to Pizza Hut for a birthday lunch. I mean, it was just utterly astonishing. I have never seen a head teacher walk into year four classroom, and he was talking about their work and looking, you know, the sort of classic walk through the school, the learning walk. So he stood there and said, anybody want a free cuddle? And 14 kids left their seats to have a cuddle with the head teacher. Now, this is good to me, because those kids who got nothing, they go scavenging for food after school, were loved, and cared for. And it's interesting, the schools I went to were prepared, and this is a key word, were to prepared to own and state the word love. They loved their kids and they mattered. I mean, this is just unbelievable. He took the kids onto the school playing field without telling them what's happening after the Britain's Got Talent. A helicopter circles the field, lands, and David Walliams gets out and does a 50-minute assembly and gives every kid a copy of his book. So I had enormous problems in the school because I nearly got into trouble because I actually tried, almost was tempted to dog nap the school dog called Mabel. I mean, this was a place you belong, and it was lovely, and I'd excited me.
It's a really nice example of someone who's embedded belonging really well and almost, it seems like, easily within the school. It was really interesting, you know, speaking about cuddles and love, and it made me think about what is the link then between well-being and belonging?
A colleague, Dominic Bingham, and myself did some research into well-being in mainly in secondary schools, and it came out of a couple of incidents. And I was talking to a friend over a supper party, and she was working in a school, a big school, and she was working on the well-being team. Now, that's an interesting one. So I, with that sort of studied naivety, which I'm very good at, I said, so what's a well-being team doing? And the next thing she said, well, we have a well-being corridor. And I'm going for it now. And I'm saying, well, okay, a well-being corridor. What's a well-being corridor? It has sofas. And I'm thinking to myself, that has never been shown, ultimately, to be the basis of well-being, of having a sofa. It's a good, I like sofas, but it's not the basis of it. And what I found was that there was so little grasp of what the nature of well-being was. And also, tragically, was that in that school and in others, the cuts and the budget issues had meant that the well-being providers, specialists, though they had no specialism, were in the main dealing with the few rather than the many. So this particular school, which had the sofas, they'd cut the special educational needs budget. And so they were now dealing with youngsters on the autistic disorder spectrum who'd gone into meltdown. The big issue for me was that they didn't have any articulated plan of what well-being was.
So is it almost tokenistic nods towards well-being interventions?
I'm going to challenge you. I wouldn't say totally tokenistic, because they were genuine. And these are people who care. But actually, their knowledge about what was going on was lamentable, to be honest. I mean, if you go back to the 1940s, then you have Maslow. But it has that sort of sense that you have essential needs which have to be met before you get on to the higher order thinking. So if you're wet, cold, and hungry, basically, you're not going to get involved in maths. Now, the problem is there's always exceptions. And we know there are a number of examples of composers who have been starving to death and got TB, who produce amazing pieces of music. But that's misleading, because this isn't the commonplace. If a child is abused, if they're maltreated, if they're hungry, you know, how are they going to go into areas like self-actualization?
And there's a lot of other theory which has come around more recently that also supports these ideas, isn't there?
Yes, you go into the work of somebody much more contemporary, like Martin Seligman, who is the positive psychologist who many people know. He came up with a model called the PERMA model, P-E-R-M-A. And this started with positive emotions leading to engagement, leading to positive relationships, leading to meaning, and then his A of perma was accomplishment. So this underpinned a lot of what was going on. It's the problem in many instances is the difference between hedonistic well-being and eudaimonic well-being. And hedonistic well-being is wishful thinking. My wife provides me with a bacon sandwich. It's probably not going to happen, believe me, but I get that. I eat it. It's good. You know, I like that. That's in the moment. The eudaimonic, which is about fulfillment-based well-being, where the person feels secure. They're embedded in a network of nurturing relationships and identifying with a purpose greater than oneself. And you can see both of those immediately impact purpose, well-being, belonging, and the rest of it. And undoubtedly, eudaimonic well-being is much richer. And without it, hedonistic, the experiential well-being, of it will have little impact or substance. So it's these richer experiences which ultimately underpin well-being, and not simply have some sort of instantaneous flash in the pan.
So just to stop you there, this hedonistic well-being is the sense of immediate gratification, something feels good in the moment, whereas eudaimonic is being part of something and it's longer lasting, and it's feeling those nurturing, warm, welcoming relationships. And so what if you don't have that part of well-being?
If you haven't got that eudaimonic dimension, it's not going anywhere. And people need to feel they belong. So there is a massive, massive link. Clearly, outside the school, some horrendous things going on. And the school isn't going to solve all of those. It never has been able to, it never will. But it shouldn't be added to it. And when I did the research on well-being, one of the things every single one of them mentioned was examination stress. And there was almost that sense that, but moving on. So we're not going to do anything about it, but we know it's a massive influence. And you've got youngsters falling apart at the seams.
Yeah, so the message is really that if you meet certain of these needs and the sense of belonging and eudaimonic well-being, that then the learning will follow, rather than focusing just on the learning, which might increase the exam stress and probably becomes a vicious circle.
Yes, there is no doubt at all that the more in a state of personal equilibrium with a clear sense of self-identity, security, then once they've got those settled, they can move on. And yes, absolutely. I mean, this is Seligman's work in a nutshell. This is Burma. It's accomplishment. My family were turkey farmers in Norfolk, and they used to have a place called Mock Beggar Hall with a ballroom. And I was very impressed until I found out they actually kept the turkeys in the ballroom, which was a bit off. And one of the things that sage pieces of advice from my Norfolk relatives was never try and stuff a live turkey, because it's dangerous. But that's what we're doing in education. We don't get people in a good place. Instead, we take them as they are and try and stuff Paxo into an orifice where it doesn't belong. Some youngsters will cope with this environment and achieve, but there are an awful lot who don't. And actually, what is the point of having a large number of GCSEs and a large number of A-levels if the process has resulted you in ending up as a basket case? Teachers are frightened words like love. And yet, isn't that what children actually need?
So we've spoken a lot about belonging in groups of children and young people, and you wrote a book about staff stress called It's Doing My Head In, And so I was wondering what you have found out about staff well-being.
I have ended up, I am a professional coach, and I've ended up working over the last 15 years or so with mainly, but not exclusively, teachers who have become highly stressed, have started to really become personally unravelled. And in fact, I've had several referrals from low GPs where I live. And what you find there, not exclusively, but a very common theme, is a very strong management by results culture, a perform or we'll manage you out of the system. And that is pernicious. And I had one, we'll call him Charles. I had one guy, Charles, referred by a local GP. And of course, he was actually an art specialist and a bit of a maverick, but producing wonderful artwork, but it didn't fit where the school wanted to go. They started to put deliberate pressure on him. And he started to come apart. He started to increase his cigarette consumption, his alcohol consumption. He couldn't sleep. He was depressed. He was anxious. And this was not exclusively, but significantly as a result of that pressure that's being exerted on the staff to perform. And some years ago now, a friend of mine called Alan Flintham did some research in Nottingham, and he did some fantastic interviews with people on this issue of staff and belonging. And I'd like to read you part of one of his interviews that he did. This was actually a head teacher, and he recorded this. He said, "If I'd had sustainability strategies, I'd have seen a way forward. The only one I had was more of the same. I enjoyed innovating, which gave me a satisfaction, but ironically caused me to work even longer hours. I had no one professionally to turn to. I would have liked a professional listening partner to share it all with. But internal staff problems meant that sort of relationship couldn't work at school, and I suffered from the professional loneliness and isolation. My self-belief was undermined. I felt a good head would have solved this, and I had no one to convince me otherwise." And I've come across so many, many people like this, where the schools have stopped looking with respect and concern for staff. Not everybody's cut out for teaching, but you don't destroy the person as you manage them.
And that quote really made me think about how, unless you have that culture of belonging within your school, being a head must be very isolating, because you're not feeling part of that eudaimonic well-being we were talking about before, about being cared for and part of a group, because you're very much on your own. That's what the hierarchy dictates of you. So that must be very challenging for some heads.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And at the end of it is that It's back to what we need to survive, and we need as much as anything to be respected, to be cared for, to feel safe. But if you manage by insecurity, which is done a lot, then you will reap something which is devastating.
And have you seen schools that have done this staff belonging thing really well? What examples have you seen of it being done well?
Yes, certainly. It is there's one school which records the most amazing silly staff videos of the staff singing together and dancing together. That's one. It's just down often to simple things where a change that's taking place. If I had a member of staff off, I would go and see that member of staff and say, "Hey, how are you? Are you okay? Anything we can help with?" Now it's a re-entry interview, and it's pointed out that you should should recognize that you've now had a percentage of your quota of time off. So it's just about looking and caring for people. If you don't feel respected, why would you give that much of yourself?
Yeah, it's very true.
I go back again. I mean, I looked at Flake Fleet and I looked at a couple of other schools. And there was a school in Coventry I looked at. And they were having their professional development day the following day. And they were doing some work in the morning on the horrendous subject of knife crime, because they'd got big gangs around. And then lunch, the head teacher had found somewhere, and unfortunately I don't have the address of it, an Indian restaurant that sold curry in buckets. Now, how good is that? From that to a pub quiz in the afternoon. Now, it's silly things like that. At the moment of pub quiz, the hierarchy breaks and people begin to share.
I really like that example. So, Max, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
It's my pleasure.
And thank you for listening. You'll find links to more of Max's work in the podcast description. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do subscribe, and you can follow us on Twitter at emcurriculum. You can email us on theemotionalcurriculum@gmail.com. See you soon.